Okay, good evening everybody. Sorry for that little delay. Some technical difficulties. This class is Bible Building Blocks, class number 5. For those of you who want to catch up, we have the CDs and tapes in the library, and all the handouts are now, thanks to Jeff Dabrowski, on our website. If you look under the learning section, you click on the learning section, you'll see Bible Building Blocks. It has all the handouts there, so thanks. Yeah. In PDF form, so thanks to Jeff for that. So if you're ever missing a class, you're missing the handouts, it should be there. God willing, we should do that often. In the first week, we went over a whole overview of the whole 5 books of the Torah. Second week, we did an overview of the book of Bereishis. And for the last 2 weeks, we did the Parsha of Bereishis and the Parsha of Noach, and we're in the middle of the Parsha of Noach. So that's the sheet that you have here. We're in the middle of Parsha's Noach. There are 3 primary stories in the Parsha of Noach: the flood, the Tower of Babel, and the 10 generations from Noach to Abraham. So we still had a little bit more to deal with in terms of the flood. And Paul said there was a question that he should remind me of. It was at the end of the class that I didn't have time to get to. So if you could.
He said there's something specific about the raven and the dog.
There was something specific about the raven and the dog that they transgressed the command that no animals or human beings should have any relations while they're in the ark. Because while the world is being destroyed, people should not take pleasure themselves, and they shouldn't take pleasure, neither should the animals. So he said there were three who sinned, so to speak. Ham, one of Noah's sons, sinned, that he was intimate with his wife. The raven sinned, and the dog sinned, and they all had intimacy. So generally, that reflects an uncontrollable desire, and that's why Noah sent the raven out. Why did he send the raven out and no other animal? Because the raven, because it was intimate, the raven's wife was already in her pregnant, whatever you call it, for an animal, gestation, whatever you call it, with having another child. So if Noah's got to lose an animal, he can lose that one because that one's already reproduced itself in the ark.
I don't know what the gender's going to be, but still.
Well, you know, I guess he could take the risk, right? Or maybe they laid a whole bunch of eggs. Who knows? So that's what happened with that. The dog, you know, is called Kelev, which is Kelev, like the heart. And the dog really, as I say, is man's best friend. And really, the dog is, to a certain degree, a slave to mankind. And we'll see in a minute how that will fit into the overall picture. And we'll see with Ham, the same thing. With Ham, ultimately, he's cursed to slavery. And we will develop that theme as we go into the next story. So though there were ramifications of being in the ark and these things happening. Anyway, the flood ends. We're at the point where the flood ends. Okay, so we're on point. We're still on the first point, the flood, and one of the last few bullet points. We discussed the rainbow last week. So as when Noah comes out, he's extremely distraught that he sees the world is destroyed. And he, so to speak, complains to God. He says, God, how could you do this? How could you destroy the whole world? Like, it's a very hard thing for us to imagine. There was a beautiful, wonderful world with everything there, and now he comes out, it's totally barren. So the Almighty says to Noah, you know, if you would have prayed harder for humanity, then this flood would not have had to come. Noah really did not believe that mankind could rise up to the challenge and repent and return to God, and therefore he did not pray for them adequately. And God said, if you would have prayed more, things could have been different. So Noah, who was a great humanitarian, but I guess didn't have enough confidence in humankind to live up to their potential, and therefore there wasn't a world to save. So then he goes out of the ark with his children, and Noah decides to work on the land. So what does he do? He had saved some agriculture with him, because there's a great question: how can he plant anything? There's no seeds. So he took things from the ark, and the first thing he plants is a vine. A vineyard. He plants a vineyard to represent a new beginning. And it's been quite a while since he's had wine. So he finally, by the time the vine is ripe and the grapes are out, he makes the wine. He drinks the wine And the wine in those days was extremely strong, extremely powerful. And without him realizing it, he gets drunk. He gets drunk. So in that state of being drunk, a very, very terrible event happens. The terrible event is his son Ham goes into the tent and castrates his father. And when Shem and Yefes see this, and he did it, in general, it's a terrible thing, and it was an indignified thing. And Shem and Yefes see this, and they see their father's uncovered, and they cover him up, and they worry about his respect. But Ham does a dastardly act. So the question is, why would Ham do such a thing? So the rabbis explain like this. Ham figures there's three sons. So we'll divide the world in three. If father is still a young, healthy man, if he has more children, we'll have to share the world with more siblings, and I'll get less of a cut of the pie. The pieces of the pie are going to be smaller. So he figures the best way to deal with this is to castrate his father. So now there's no more competition. So this is all part of Ham's mentality. Ham's mentality is, as we've said, very selfish type of person, only interested in taking for himself. That's why he couldn't hold himself back in the ark. He had to be intimate with his wife. He doesn't want to share with anybody, so he castrates his father. And again, that's a terrible thing, because that, you know, there's only four men on the world. There's only so much a possibility of having children, and he's wiped out one quarter of the potential of growth of civilization because of his selfishness. So that's a terrible act. And when Noach finds out what happens, he curses Ham and his descendants, which are Canaan. And it's all important to know these things, because it comes back to you in history. All these stories that are happening in the early times, it comes back and shapes world history and explains a lot of things. Now again, some may be a little taken aback that the Torah is not politically correct, but then again, since when do politics enter the Word of God? And the Torah gives you the story straight as it is. And therefore, Ham was cursed. What was his curse? Remember, a curse isn't the way we understand a curse. A curse is what has to be done to develop the person into being what he should become. And what does Adam say, what does Noah say about Ham? Ham should be cursed, and his children should be cursed, Canaan should be cursed, that they should be servants. Servitude should be their lives. Now again, not in the way that we depict slaves in the South in the 1800s, where they were brutal to the blacks. We're not talking about that. But a master who understands how to teach the slave how to behave. Slavery, being a servant, I like the word servant better than a slave. Slave seems to apply, he's taken advantage of, and he's hurt, and he's terrible things are done to him. A servant means that he works for the master, and his essence is reflected in his service to the master. And therefore, this is the destiny of the descendants of Ham. Why? What's the quid pro quo? What's the lesson of this? Ham, who himself is so selfish, the only way you can deal with a selfish person who wants everything for himself is he has to learn to live only for his master. A servant, by nature, a loyal servant, is one who does everything for the master. There's certain halachic principles. For example, if a servant finds something, it doesn't belong to him, it belongs to his master. A servant owns nothing. Once a descendant of Ham would get in the mood of collecting things and having things, then that unsatiable desire grows and grows and grows, and that becomes his end, his doom. The person who has unsatiable desires cannot be a free person, because that freedom destroys him. Therefore, he must have a role model of a master whose whole goal is to ensure that the slave is taken care of, the servant is taken care of, and the servant sees that role model, and therefore will understand that his behavior must be to be totally given over to someone else. And when a person lives his life totally giving himself over to someone else, that's how he cures himself from the disease of selfishness. And only the cure of selfishness is to learn to become a loyal servant. And we will see in a few weeks, Parshas, the prime example of that is Eliezer, the servant of Abraham, who was a descendant of Ham, and by being that kind of a servant, he achieves his ultimate freedom from his baser desires. And that's the destiny of the people who come from Ham. This is the nature of the Hamites. The Zohar tells us, the Medrash tells us, that part of the punishment for Ham is that his skin was turned black. Again, this is very unpolitically correct. But his skin, this is where the origins of black came in. First man was not black. First man was translucent. But after his sin, it was the way we understand flesh, white. The curse of Ham is that his skin would turn black, because black is the color that takes in, while white reflects. And we will see this as an impact on the balance of world history comes from this. I'm not making it up. Like, it's right there in the Torah. It's clear. You have to be careful, you know, in what company you're going to say certain lines and sentences. Doesn't mean that the black is doomed to never become the person he's meant to be. As we said, there's examples that there were blacks who understood to use servitude as a means to gain their freedom from their baser desires, and they became unbelievably righteous people, like Eliezer. In Avram's generation, there are only two righteous people. Avraham, the white man, descendant of Shem. Eliezer, the black man, the descendant of Ham. They were the only two righteous people in the entire generation. So therefore, when you only have two righteous people, and one is white and one is black, that's a pretty good ratio. So there's no reason to say that they cannot evolve into the free people that they're meant to become. And certainly in halacha, there is room to give them freedom once they understand what it means to give as opposed to take. It's a long discussion, and then we go later in the Torah, you go to Parshas Mishpatim and other Parshas, this concept gets fully developed. But you see in the very beginnings of creation, there were different types of people. Shame, we understand. Shame comes from, what does shame mean in Hebrew? It means name. Name. What's the idea of name? We know that first man named all the animals. Naming isn't just, you know, just giving a convention and saying, oh, I'll call him horse because I'm in the mood to call him horse. We already explained a few weeks ago that Adam penetrated the depths with his intellect to understand the essence of the animals. A name, when you can give a name to something, that means you define the essence of what you're dealing with, and that means there's a high-powered intellect going on. So shame was the high-powered intellect. A high-powered intellect that lets his brains make his decisions will ultimately be a supreme giver. And shame is the descendant of Noah who represents that holy aspect of giving. And that's what shame represents. Ham, on the other hand, what does the word ham mean in Hebrew? Ham means hot. Hot-blooded. Emotional. Lustful. So he lets his emotions control who he is. And if you let your emotions control who you are, you become a taker as opposed to a giver. What I want as opposed to what I know should be. Yefes, on the other hand, he's in the middle. Yefes comes from the word yefeh, which is beautiful, which represents beauty. That is initially a very good combination with shame. Brilliance, intellect, can build the most beautiful, what's the most beautiful structure that ever existed? The temple. Was the most beautiful structure. Buddha's beauty centered around intellect. The intellect that's saying the purpose of creation is to bring a place for God to reside in this world. And certainly for God's sake, we beautify it to honor God. And to understand that beauty is of value when it is focused in beautifying spiritual things as opposed to beautifying physical things for their own sake. And we had within the three brothers a tremendous potential. If the three would have used their three talents properly and together, with Shem's intellect directing traffic, Ham's emotion following the directions of Shem's intellect. It's good once you are intellectually aware that this is the reality. For example, I intellectually understand that it's important to be kind to others. Now, you could be kind in a very cold, dispassionate way, intellectually, or you can now infuse it with emotion and saying, and this is such a powerful idea, my whole being gets excited about this. And now you do it with zest and vim and vigor, and then you add the third part and you try to beautify the mitzvah, because we know in the Torah there's a concept of beautifying the mitzvah. So there's three aspects that can be beautiful. You got the intellect determining what you should do, what's right, to get emotionally involved, and to do it in the most beautiful way. That is a very good grouping, the three together. The problem that existed, the rabbis say, and this is where the terrible downfall comes, because Ham castrated his father, what really happened was there was supposed to be a fourth child. And when you have a lot of great attributes, you still need one more critical aspect, and in Hebrew we call it malchus, we call it royalty, is to be able to take those three powers and harness them together. You need to have a certain power that power doesn't really have any power in and of itself, doesn't have greatness of kindness, doesn't have greatness of anything, but knows how to channel the resources in a way that work harmoniously together. So without that fourth child was destined, the rabbis say, to take those three forces and use them together. Since that child never came into being, these other three are running with three separate strengths, but there's no cohesiveness to these strengths, and therefore, that's why why would the Torah tell us such a story? The Ham castrated his father, who cares? It's a very ignoble story. But it's saying, because of that, there was just like by Adam and Eve, they had two sons, one got killed, and then they had another one later, that Chase, and from Chase came the rest of civilization. Same thing, Noah was supposed to have another child after the flood, and that would be the untainted child. The first three children lived in a corrupt world. Noah and his three children barely survived that spiritually. Now what would be best is to bring in a new child that only knows about this new, beautiful, new world. That would be the king, so to speak. That would be the linchpin to take all these energies and coalesce them in a positive way. Since Noah was castrated, he was doomed to not have that other child. Now you've got three powerful forces not working together. And what happens as a result of that, civilization spreads out. Ultimately, three different types of individuals. So if you look what we wrote, Shem really populates Asia. The descendants of Shem populate Asia. And as we mentioned, Jews, Christians, Romans, Muslims, Orientals. That's that zone of the world, so to speak. As we learn more, we'll see how they descend from that. And in general, Shemites are givers. Of course, you can corrupt giving. We'll talk about it. In general, the nature of Shem was to be a giver. So Semitic people, the Torah is saying, are generally givers. Now, in every attribute, there's a positive aspect of it and a negative aspect of it. And we can understand how in the Muslims, unfortunately, that has been taken to the negative way, where giving can be corrupted, which we'll talk about it later. We'll talk about this later when we get to Yishmael. On the other hand, the Hamites, which really he inhabits Africa, Egypt, the Canaanites, the Philistines, that represents the quintessential takers. And then Yefes represents Europe, Greek, Persia. That's kind of in between. And kind of gets tugged. Sometimes they vacillate towards the Shemites. Sometimes they vacillate to the Hamites. And all of world history evolves from this. Okay. Any questions up to this point? Yeah? I think it's a very powerful, powerful story here. Very powerful. Yeah?
First Ham and
Canaan. Canaan said, son of Ham. Well, yes, many of these places were named after people. Eretz Canaan, the land of Canaan, which becomes the forerunner of Israel, was populated by the Canaanites. That's right.
Israel
what?
The country. It's after the person, Israel.
Is after Israel. Yeah, many of the names, places are named after people.
So the place wasn't cursed. He was cursed.
He was cursed. He was cursed. He was cursed. Okay, yeah?
The spreading out happened immediately.
Well, it happens pretty soon. Pretty soon. They start moving on their way. Now, they may not have reached all these furthest reached places yet. What I'm telling you now about Asia, Africa, Europe doesn't totally get to that point then. It's in the future.
I see the next kind of, but I thought the dispersion happened as a result.
Right, so I'm saying that's in the future. But they said the seeds for the future. The future, ultimately, these three are lacking any nucleus, and eventually they all spread out. Okay? Okay, excellent. Let's move on now to the next story. Yes? Yes? Remember, we said in the beginning, God created the world to have a nation of people that will be the recipients of the kindness that He wants to bestow upon them. That nation is called Yisrael. It was not designated in advance who this would be. It was open to any individual or groups who want to be part of the chosen people. When God created the world, He did not say, it's going to be Abraham and his children and this. And the way we understand Jews, these are chosen people. God says, it's open to everyone and anyone. That was the opening message of Genesis. So and it could have been Adam. And Adam blew it. And it could have been any of his 10 generations of descendants. And they messed up. And it could have been Noah. And it could have been Shem. And Chom and Yavis. It was there for the taking. Who wants to be the nation that will have this relationship with God, that will commit their lives to bring God's reality down to this world and will enjoy that relationship with God? Open to everybody. And at this point, we don't see any takers. Okay? We don't see any takers. Which brings us now to the next story. Now remember, the flood was in what? 1656. So over the next 300 years, civilization evolves. And there is a lot of strife between these descendants. And ultimately we come to the next story, the Tower of Babel. Which, why is it called Babel? Because really it was situated in a place that's called Bavel, which we say Babylonia. Bavel is in the Fertile Crescent. It is now known as Iraq, in between the two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. This is where civilization was primarily started out. And what happened is the following. The Torah gives you a very simplistic rendering of this, and we have to spice it up a little medrash to appreciate the depths of what's going on over here. There was one fellow who was a descendant of Ham, and his name was Nimrod. He is a very important name in world history. Nimrod. Nimrod, the root of Nimrod comes from the word mered, which means rebel. So his whole Weltanschauung was to get the world to rebel against God. That was his whole point. So Nimrod comes up with an amazing idea. The world, we have to remember one thing. People make a mistake and think that if somebody was from the world of the ancients, it means that they weren't very advanced. And that's a terrible mistake. Ancient is not equated with lack of advancement, lack of civilization. The ancients were extremely bright, extremely intelligent. They had all kinds of scientific and mystical understandings of the creation of the world, well beyond what we understand even today. You should just know, there was a book of cures that was in the hand of mankind that could cure any disease. Mankind at this time was extremely sophisticated. May not have computers, but you don't need computers. If you know the mystical words and what to say, you can do all kinds of things that you don't need a computer for. This has fallen into disuse. It's been lost to civilization. But they had unbelievable powers. So the people in the world, they said like this. We see that in 1656, there was an amazing flood that wiped out the world. So you know what? Our calculations determine that every 1,656 years, God wipes out the world. Notwithstanding, God put a rainbow and says he's not going to do it again. They said, you know what? Can't trust God. Every 1,656 years, he's going to wipe us out. And he wipes us out because we don't behave. So here is the game plan, guys. We have the technology, the mystical technology, any technology that we need. And we got 1,600 years to work on the technology to make us impervious to whatever God can throw at us. We can create, whatever you want to call it, the sky dome in heaven. And this is what the tower represented. What the tower represented was that Nimrod was able, in a negative way, not in a positive way, in a negative way, to get the entire world together. But not for a positive purpose, but for a negative purpose. And the purpose was to be able to create a civilization that would not have to deal with God at all. And that's what the tower was. They built a very huge tower going up into the heavens, and it was very successful. And the technology was unbelievable. And the game plan was they could create what we would call, like I said, say a sky dome in heaven that no earthquake can destroy it, no storms can destroy it, and the technology would take many, many years to make this happen. And they were on the path to making that happen. And they were so advanced technologically, the rabbis say, that it would take 1 year to bring a brick. This was a time when the world had invented the brick. That was a big invention that we take for granted. Until that time, you could live in a hut. You couldn't, there was no thing as stories and floors. They invented the brick, and the brick now can let you go as high as you need to go. So it would take a year to carry a brick from the bottom level all the way to the top. The Medrash says if a brick, if you're at the top and you dropped a brick, they mourned greatly for that brick. But if a human being fell off the tower and died, they couldn't care less. And this was a generation that was known as the just like every generation was known for a negative fault. We've read this is three generations. In Book of Bereishis, which generation do we talk about? The generation of Enosh. The generation of Enosh was a world of idolatry. We talked about that last week or 2 weeks ago. The generation of the flood was a generation of immorality. And the generation of the Tower of Babel is the generation of murder. The generation of murder. Even though they're together, but there was no care for human life. It was technology was supreme, and human life was secondary to that. So it's subtle forms of murder, but still murder it is. So what happens? So this, so they're ready to go, and they're ready to wage war with God, so to speak. Now, you gotta understand, are you crazy? How can you wage war with God? So now we're gonna share with you a very interesting idea that the Malbim says, and this is very important. Now, the years are very important here. Abraham, who is the 10th generation descendant of Noah, he is born, as we said, in what year? 1948 to creation. Okay, 1996, Nimrod and his group are at the peak of their tower. Okay, now let's try to understand what's going on over here. Nimrod had a very genius plan. The plan, and the reason why we learn these stories is because these stories keep repeating themselves. They just take on more contemporary postures now. But it's no different. All the stories come back and all the lessons come back. Nimrod said like this, God is very powerful. He's extremely powerful. But he can only do so much. What does that mean? Well, they learned a lot of lessons from the flood. See, the flood, the commentaries say, why did God bring the flood? The God brought a flood because there was still one tzaddik called Noah. What would have happened if the entire world was corrupt? There wasn't one human being who was decent. Then the rabbis say, God would not destroy a world. Why? Because there'd be no point to it. If everyone is corrupt, remember, God only punishes or disciplines for a purpose. So why did he destroy the whole world with a flood? So Noah could carry on the hope of mankind. If the purpose of mankind is there should be a group of people who want to have a relationship with God, right? So now, as long as there's one person who still is devoted to that task, but he is slowly getting enveloped by the rest of the world, and as a matter of time until Noah will be sucked into this, and if it's not him, his children. So God says, the only thing I can do is I have to destroy the world for the sake of Noah and for the sake of the future of humanity. And that's why the Torah goes out of its way to say in Parshas Noah that the whole world is corrupt except for Noah. Noah was a tzaddik. What's the big deal? What's the stress? The stress is because he was a tzaddik, there was still something worth disciplining. There was still something worth saving. And a destructive act of a flood will be the ultimate salvation for Noah and the hopes for mankind in the future. Nimrod is very clever. He learns his history very well. And he's saying, so the way to avoid God's wrath is to ensure that not one human being wants a relationship with God. If we can get the whole world to go against God, it effectively makes God powerless. Makes God powerless. Because it would be pointless to destroy the world. Do you understand? Do you understand the point? What would God do? He'd destroy the world for what reason? There's nobody to save. He's going to kill them all except for one. There's not even one. So, what the mystics say about this generation, they say they wanted to cut themselves off from their roots. The roots are God, the relationship with God. They want to cut themselves off. What they want to say is, we will determine our own destiny without God's involvement in our lives. Up to now, God's been involved in the world. He gives you a free will choice. Based on your free will choice, God responds positively or negatively in order to keep things going. Humanity got to the point and says, you know what, God? We don't need you. We don't want you. We can run our own lives without you. Thank you. We're very smart. And therefore, they want to cut the bond between them and God. How can you cut the bond? Isn't he going to come back with a flood and say, no. We're going to make sure that by the time the next 1656 years comes on, the whole world will be together in this concept of revolting against God. And there won't be one loyalist to God. And once that happens, God will not be able to do anything to us. That was the strategy. It was an unbelievable genius strategy. And as they say, it nearly worked. It nearly worked. And now you will see as history continues, who are the, become the two, as always, remember, protagonists and antagonists throughout world history. Start from Adam and the snake. Protagonist, antagonist. Cain and Abel, protagonist, antagonist. We go throughout history. Noah and the rest of the world, protagonist, antagonist. There's always going on. Shem and Ham, protagonist, antagonist. How does it develop into the next generation? It's going to become Avraham and Nimrod. Become the next polar extremes. Avram, a descendant from Shem, the giver. Nimrod, the descendant from Ham, the taker. And that's how history continues with this struggle. So now, we have a whole world that is going to the other side. They're saying, you know, we love mankind. We're humanitarians. Look what we're doing. We're going to create, it sounds very good in the newspapers, it reads very well. Nimrod leads the world to be able to protect themselves from any natural disasters that could ever happen. We've reinforced the structures to support an earthquake beyond 10 of the Richter scale. What is that really saying? Now, it sounds very good. But the Torah writes, and God heard what was going on. He said, I can't let them do this. Because if they would have fulfilled their plans, then once you can develop within yourself total self-sustenance, then you don't think you need God anymore. And the plan for the world ceases to exist. So when you read about advancements in society that are saying, look, we are now impervious to the forces of nature, that's a serious code you should be breaking and understand what that means. It means we don't want God to mess around in our lives. Now, it's a subtle message because on the other hand, it sounds so good. It sounds so kind. We will find a cure for this disease and that disease and every disease. But you know what we're not going to do? We're not going to stop behaving like animals. Right? There's diseases in this world. So what do the humanitarians say? Let's stop the disease. But the spiritual person say, let's stop the behavior that brings the diseases. If you really loved mankind, isn't that what you should be doing? No, we still want to live like animals. We want to live with no rules. But we see that some natural force is hurting us because of this behavior. So we will attack the natural force. We'll make that natural force not be able to hurt us. And we can continue to live in a way that is not the way that God wants us to live. And we are called humanitarians. Now, God forbid, there's many humanitarians that really want and understand this. They're just missing the key point. The real humanitarian is the godly person who teaches the world, maybe you should change your behaviors and the sickness won't even begin anymore. Obviously, people who are sick, we have to help them, and that is humanitarian. But that's short-sighted humanitarianism. It never solves the problem. We've looked through world history. There's never been a generation that hasn't suffered from a new disease. Well, as soon as we cure one disease, the next disease comes. As soon as we cure that disease, the next is. It's a cat and mouse game. Why is it happening? Because as the world gets smarter to cure one disease, they drop lower morally and commit more sins. So the diseases just follow them. Now, if you don't believe in God, you say, what a coincidence. If you're a God-fearing person, you realize that God is telling the world, I'm not happy with what you're doing. So where does it start from? It starts from the Tower of Babel. That's why this is such an important story. In the Torah, it's only 11 verses. You can miss it because you hear about the flood, you forget about the Tower of Babel. Tower of Babel was world opinion and world desire to cut God out of any supremacy with the world, to want to have no relationship with the world. And God says, if I let it get away, go further, they will succeed. They will succeed. So what does God do? So there's one thing. God always keeps an ace up his sleeve. Up to this point in time, the world saw God in his manifestation. There's different manifestations of God. The most obvious manifestation of God is through nature. Through nature. Sometimes a little bit of nature, sometimes there's a lot of nature at one time. Well, it rains, it's a little bit of nature. And of course, you know, God can hide behind that. You can't tell it's God. When there's a massive flood, whew, that was a lot of nature. That was a lot of nature. But, you know, God yet did not do something yet in the world. He kept a secret from the world. What was that? The world until 1996 said, you know, whatever God can do, he is restrained within the context of nature. God can deal with us. He can be the boss over us, but within limitations. The limitation is nature. So God can bring us lots of rain, abundance of it, a year's worth. He can make hurricanes. He can make earthquakes. But you know what? All those secrets, all those powers are from nature. And we can unlock those secrets of nature, and we can counter anything that God can send to us. And that's true. Nimrod's mistake. Everybody always makes this one little mistake. Adam made this little mistake. Everyone makes this mistake. He didn't realize that the creator of heaven and earth is not limited by nature. If he created nature, he can act in ways that are beyond nature. God never showed it yet to the world. World historians only saw, well, God did this, God did this. It's all natural things he did. So God says, okay, you think that you can outsmart me? And I'll let you have lots of rope. I want to see how far you can go. And they went very, very far. They went almost to the end. They went so far they had taken care of every single human being on the planet, except for one, Avraham. And God says, okay, now we've come to the point where I can't give him any more rope, because he may kill Avraham soon, and then I'm in trouble. I'm just telling you more like a story. I mean, God never for a minute thought he was in trouble. But so God says, okay, at this point in time, I'm going to unleash something you guys never, ever saw. Now remember, at the same time, God is patiently waiting. He's waiting which nation is going to come forth and say, we want to be your people. And it's now almost 20 generations. Nobody's interested. We call this mystically the era of roots. The roots. Every civilization, every group of human beings, they're determining where they fit in the context of world civilization from God's perspective. And God's been awfully patient. Everyone's been messing up terribly. God says, you know what? Let me just finish something. This is it. This is the end. 1996 in world history is another watershed event of world history. At that point, we can't explain how he did it. God takes all the people there, and he divides them. All of a sudden, the next morning, everybody wakes up speaking a different language. All of a sudden, there's 70 different languages. All of a sudden, there's 70 different, what do you call it? Ethnics. Ethnics.
Ethnicities.
What?
Ethnicities.
Ethnicities. They just wake up, and boom. This guy, and what happens to building the tower? There's no communication. Communication systems are down. People are different. They don't understand each other. And what happens is, and then God, he scatters them about. And they find themselves scattered all over the world. It's 70 different little nations. And these become, as the rabbi tells, the core 70 nations of the world. This is an event where God says, that's it. You have determined by your behavior what kind of human beings you are. None of you can ever become as a nation the Jewish people. You've made your free will choices, and I gave you 2,000 years to make choices. There has to finally be an end to the time limit. I was patient with you. I was kind to you. I destroyed the world to give you another chance. You didn't. And what did you do to thank for it? And there was lots of bounty and lots of science and lots of... What do you do? You're rebelling against me again. So fine. Now you're locked in. And those 70 nations, their personality types, their lack of supreme spirituality is locked in. And the 70 nations, the quote-unquote, even though you have many more countries in the UN now, it all roots to the 70 nations, so to speak. And you as nations can never be Jewish again. You'll be different, and this will be the source of all wars. Your differences will create wars between yourselves. You'll be so busy fighting with yourselves, you'll never be able to unite and fight against me again. This is what we call God working in the supernatural way. There's no, a scientist can explain the flood, a scientist can explain the splitting of the sea, they can try to explain anything, but you can't explain how everybody one day wakes up with 70 different languages. Until this point, everybody spoke Lashon HaKodesh, the holy Hebrew tongue with the olive base. At this point, nobody spoke that language except for who? Avraham. And at that point, Hashem says, the whole world is finished. They're failures in terms of becoming the special people. By their choice, not by mine. There's only one person left, Avraham. He's the last one I vote for. Okay, that shows you how critical this event was. And that's why we say the era of roots has ended. Avram is the only human to maintain his godliness. That spirit, that special soul that was going for 20 generations. There were certain leaders who had this special soul that could connect to God. Humanity stripped it away from themselves through their corrupt actions, and subsequent children would lose it till they lost that holy high level soul. All human beings have a soul. But they've totally rebelled against God, and now they remain as what we call the B'nai Noach, the Noachites, and they cannot, as nations, become Jews. There's only one potential nation now. Anyone who comes from Avraham can potentially become the nation called the chosen people who will be connected to God. And that happens in the year 1996. Okay, question.
How long, in biblical sense, is a generation?
It depends, you know, if we look in the earlier years, it took people would live for, let's say, 600, 700, 800 years. After the flood, it dramatically cut down to like 200 years, and then they could have children after a certain period of times. So we talk those 20 generations lasted approximately 2,000 years. Right, so yeah, on average, it was a 100-year generation. That drops drastically as time moves on. It drops down to now what we have now, 20, 30 years as a generation.
But the first 10 is 1,600 years, the first 10.
Well, it was a little more than that, because the flood was in 1656, and Noah was already 500 years. So there were many generations. But he lived for 500 years, more than that, lived many, many more years. And the flood didn't happen until he was 620. So he was born about the year 1000. So it's about 1,000 years for the first generation. People lived long into the next generations, but after the flood, after many generations already lived, then it gets cut down drastically. And then from 1656, you have 8 generations till the year 1948. So it's much less time for those next generations. Yeah, Leo.
Just wanted to go back here to Nimrod. You talk about murder. Can you just spend a minute and explain exactly what he did, what kind of rebellions, and how bad he really was?
No, murder means, first of all, Nimrod was the first official. Not the first official. He continued and perpetuated the idea of hunting. He was called a Gibor Tzayid, a hunter. He hunted many ways. He hunted animals. He hunted people. He would know what to do, what was politically expedient for his...
Was he a
king? He was like the ruler. He was the ruler of the world. He through various wars, and we will see, moving on to the book of Lech Lecha, many conquests, he was able to get everybody to see it his way, so to speak. So there was a lot of power that he was accumulating, and we said there was more care about technology than human life. If a person died, it was no big deal to them. We have more people than we need. So people were used to just work them till they died. So there were, it was murder, not in the classic sense, always, but it was a disregard for the value of human life.
Like the Muslims.
I'm not. We will see. The Muslims is a complicated thing. We have to talk about that. We get to Ishmael. We will talk about that. Yeah.
The fish survived, right?
The fish survived.
Fish, dolphins, whales.
Fish survived.
Were they not being immoral?
The fish were not immoral because they were subterranean, so they were not involved in the pollution of the world. They were not. That's why we. That's why. Who was here on Monday? That's why we eat fish on Shabbos. We fish on Shabbos because fish are in the ocean. That's from a different part of the world. It's not of this world, not of this world. Shabbos is a day not of this world. It's the world to come. So that's why we eat fish that represent that.
Friday and Saturday.
Shabbos, the whole Shabbos, all three meals you eat fish. All three meals you eat fish. Very important to eat fish on Shabbos. The Gemara, even from the times of Gemara, it says you eat fish on Shabbos. Yeah. There's a lot more to this. I'd need another hour to really discuss what fish and flood really is, but this is supposed to be an overview, so I can't.
These are like the fish and stuff that get in the sea.
No fish died in the flood. No fish died in the flood. They were all there. Yeah.
I have no trouble with this because Shem was the son of Noah, but he was also a contemporary with Abraham and later. Right? We talked about how Rivka went to Shem for advice. So was he not?
Okay, so Paul's asking a good question. He's catching me. The truth is, was it only Avraham? There were still a couple others. There were still Shem and Aver, two other people who were tzaddikim. So the answer was, there were a few other tzaddikim, but they were hiding in the closet. Shem and Aver, they had their little tent, and they learned to run their little tent, and they minded their own business. Avraham didn't stay in his tent. He went out. Challenged Nimrod. He says, you can't do this. This doesn't make any sense. He went, right? It goes to his father's house and he destroys all the idols. He's an activist. So there is only one activist. The rabbis say, if you're religious, but you're not active, they say, the one who sits in silence as the world goes down the drain is called the brother of the destroyer. You can be a very religious person, but you see things happening, and you just, doesn't bother me. I'm sitting in my tent, I'm doing my own thing, I'm learning my Torah, I'm mystifying, and I'm communing with God by myself. I'm watching the whole world rot, and I'm just sitting in my tent. You are really, in effect, no better than the rest of them. So they were a personal tzaddik, but that is not going to change the world. They will die, and that's the end of them. And they make no impact on the world. Avram was an impact person. That's what you had to have. Noach was a potentially impact person. He tried to impact. Noach tried. Problem is, he didn't pray for people, as the mystics explain. He didn't pray for them. He didn't throw all the artillery out. Abraham was an impact person, and he prayed for people. And that's how he's able to change people's lives. So that's why it was Abraham on the one hand, everybody else on the other side.
So Hashem wouldn't have destroyed the world for shame.
Right, because for shame he's doing nothing because of Avraham, and that's why Nimrod you'll find throughout the Torah. Nimrod has to get Avraham. He's like the last one. If I can get Avraham, and that's why you look at all the stories. Like he's just one guy. What's your problem? Let him go. You know, go now to Hitler in Mein Kampf. What does he write? He says, as long as one Jew is alive, that germ, that seed is there. Hitler, he killed 6 million Jews. And he writes at the end, this was a total failure. He says, we couldn't wipe them all out. We failed. Why? Because the non-Jew knows better than the Jew how important one Jew is. One Jew. Right? And that's why it has to be total annihilation of the Jews. Wasn't, you know, because if they're there, you can't make this happen. So that this, all this history plays itself over and over and over again, and you'll find it's irrational to the extent that Nimrod tries to put this Avram away. Because he knows as long as there's one Jew who's got the guts to go and speak out against, God will now go after the world. And he will destroy the world for the sake of the tzaddik. That's how important one human being is. Yeah.
What was Nimrod's end?
What was Nimrod's end? We will talk about that in Parshas Toldos. In Parshas Toldos, we see that Esav does one good thing in his life. He kills Nimrod, and you'll find in Parshas Toldos, the day that Nimrod, it was last week, Esav comes from the field, he's hungry, right? Why was he? He was hungry and tired. Why? Because he had a massive fight with Nimrod. To the end. Nimrod was extremely strong. He was extremely strong. And Esav kills Nimrod in the fields. Now look at this. He comes back, and what does he find out? His brother's cooking a pot of lentils. Why? Because to feed to his father the mourner. Because Avraham died that day. The cycle of history to the day. Avram and Nimrod, who are the antagonists and protagonists, they must die on the same day. And who become the next antagonists and protagonists of world civilization? Yaakov and Esau. It always has to fit that way. You'll find it throughout history. And it's a theme that constantly comes over and over. Okay? So that was the end of Nimrod. But Nimrod is alive and well for the next 3-4 parshios. And we will see as we move into Parshas Lech Lecha, we'll get to it next week. I think you have to label this as class 4 and 5, Noach, as opposed to Lech Lecha being 5. You know what I'm talking about, Jeff, because it's taken to it. It's good. So, but that's why Nimrod is constantly astray with Avram, without question. Yeah?
You mentioned, the flood was in the year 1656, and you mentioned that every 1650 odd years...
They thought that way. They thought that way.
So not in the year 3300 something happened and then 4, 9, 5.
Well, that would be like 3312. That's not far from 3338, which was the destruction of the first temple.
And then another.
So that was a pretty catastrophic event.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you have the idea, but you're a little bit off. Yes, almost every 1600 years is a catastrophe. So, the destruction of the temple was a big catastrophe.
And then after that, what is the next
big one? I'd have to work out the math. I haven't thought about it. It's a good project for me to work on. It's a good project for me to work out. That could have been the Crusades. I'm not sure. We'd have to check it out. Yeah?
Where does Nimrod come from? Who were his parents?
Descendant of Ham.
Ham was his father?
No, but descendant of Ham. A descendant of Ham, the descendant of the takers. Okay, so we follow what's going on over here.
Ham was that Nimrod wasn't in servitude and hence had this attribute.
See, that's the thing. Since Nimrod comes from Ham, and to truly develop properly, should have been a servant. But instead, he becomes the boss. Give freedom to the people who are supposed to be servants. Historically says is disaster. Go look in current world history, see the same thing. Nobody's surprised. When you're trying to civilize people who are supposed to be servants, you'll only have one result: destruction. Again, it's not politically correct, but it is not changed an iota in history. You give the people who should be servants exactly what they want, all the freedom. They can't handle it, and they bring destruction to their world. Okay, let's just finish up the last part. So that's a good story. So now we move on to the 10 generations. Now, what you really are having over here, if I had a board, it would be better. I'm not going to bother you with it, but you should write this down. There's some fascinating things you're going to see where we're up to in world history at this point. The Mishnah Pirkei Avos says a very fascinating idea. It says there are 3 negative characteristics that will drive a person out of this world. It'll totally make you meshuggah. You can't live as a sound, normal person in this world. It talks about kina, jealousy, ta'ava, lust, and kavod, honor, drive a person out of this world. If you have any of those 3, you can't live like a normal person. You can be a smart, intelligent person, but if you're jealous, jealousy causes you the craziest things, the most irrational things. You can't enjoy this life. If you're looking for honor, you go after lust, you can't. Those are the 3 critical things. It drives you out of this world.
What are they again?
Jealousy, lust, and honor.
How honor?
I'm looking for kavod. Kavod.
Yeah.
You have to respect me. You have to honor me. That's a false pleasure. Why aren't you thinking I'm the smartest person in the world? You know, and what people do to get honor, what crazy things people do that people should respect and honor them. It's a false pleasure. The Talmud says you're supposed to run away from honor. He who runs away from honor, the runner will run after him. He who runs after honor, honor will run away from him. So it's crazy. Why do you want to honor? It's the most ridiculous thing you can want. Jealousy. Why be jealous of what somebody else has? God gave it to somebody else, not for you. What God gave him is meant for him, it's not meant for you. These are irrational things. Being driven by lusts and drives, people can destroy their lives over a secretary. They destroy their lives. Happily marry this, and for a brief encounter, you destroy your life. Right? These are irrational things that totally put you out of the world. Now, what are the manifestations of this? The most stark manifestations. So let's look. A person who really wants a lot of pleasure, what's the starkest manifestation of that? That would be, a pleasure, right? If you want pleasure, the starkest manifestation is immorality. That's the extreme. Immorality is the quintessential byproduct of lust. Okay? Honor, what's the quintessential byproduct of honor? Murder. Murder. Why? Because how can I be bigger than somebody else? By killing him. And that's how I get my honor. The ultimate honor is I'm on top of the other guy. How am I on top of the guy? I kill him. That's the ultimate. We can put people down. We can insult them. But the best way to get honor is by killing people. All right? I'm sorry. Okay. Reverse that. I'm sorry. I skipped it. That's according to one interpretation. Let me back it up. Let's back that up. False honor, of course you'll kill people for honor, but deeper thing is, will lead to idol worship. Because ultimately, who gets the real honor? God. Who's supposed to get the honor in this world? God. I can't give God honor, because that will take away my honor. So if I worship idols, then my honor is restored. Remember, idol worship really, instead of man being in God's image, is God being in man's image. So the ultimate manifestation of honor is idol worship. Idol worship. The ultimate manifestation of jealousy is murder. So let's repeat that again. The ultimate manifestation of lust is immorality. The ultimate manifestation of jealousy is murder. And the ultimate manifestation of honor is idol worship. So now, we've had three individuals who have fallen to this, and three civilizations who have fallen to this up to this point in the Torah. We start with first man. First man, he fails. He doesn't listen to God. It's totally rebelling against God. That's idol worship. It's idol worship. God said, don't do this. He didn't do this. That's idol worship. Cain, what does he do? He's the jealous one who was jealous that his brother's offering was taken. What does he do? He murders. Cham, the lustful one, what does he do? He gets involved in immorality. He's involved in the flood, having more kids. He castrates his father. And other opinions say it wasn't castration, it was homosexuality. Yeah. Okay, so whole discussion over there. Maybe he had a relation with his father and then castrated him. Probably both. Anyway, he was an immoral person. So look what we have. We have three people. Adam, Cain, and Ham all succumb to honor, jealousy, and lust. Idol worship, bloodshedding, and immorality. Paralleling that are three generations. At the end of the book of Genesis, the generation of Enosh was a generation of idolatry. The generation of the flood was a generation of immorality. And the generation of Tower of Babel was a generation of murderers. So you have in the first two parshas of the Torah, everything you could do wrong, society has done it. There's nothing new. Ein chadash tachas hashemesh. There's nothing new under the sun. You have an individual. We have now six stories. See how that? It's not just Stam stories. You have three individual stories. Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, Ham and his brothers, and Noach. An individual level, they fall in these three. And three generations of Enosh, the Dor HaMabul, the flood, and the Dor HaFlaga. We call in Hebrew the Dor HaFlaga. HaFlaga means dispersal, the Tower of Babel, in three ways. Now, this leads us into future parshas. If the world has descended in such a way, the only way it's going to get saved is this all has to be undone. This has to be corrected. Mankind has hit rock bottom, and there were two tries already at this. And it's just sinking worse. Anything that could be wrong, man did wrong. And now society, as opposed to when we started the book, where the perfection of the world was 99.9% perfect, and Adam had to only control his urges for a couple hours, and the world would come to its completion. So not only did we get the world destroyed once, at this point in the year 1948, 1996, the world is the opposite. It's 99.9% not spiritual. And the only spirituality that's hanging on is Avraham. Now, I'm telling you all this so you can appreciate who Avraham was. And you can appreciate that, well, Noah was a tzaddik, he still failed in the ultimate sense. And Avram, what he has to contend with. And this is, why is that so important? Because that's where we come from. So we'll begin to appreciate who we are. And that's how the Parsha closes, very quickly, point three. Then the Parsha finishes the 10 generations from Noah to Avraham. Just quickly goes through them. The 9th generation is Terach, who has 3 sons, Avraham, Nahor, and Haran. Haran has 2 daughters, Sarai and Milcah. And then we get to all the stories of Avram, how he rebels against his father, which will lead into next week's Parsha. But look at interesting parallels between Parshas Bereishis and Noach. Those are like bookends. On the one hand, Adam and Chava are alone in the world. And then what do we have in Noach? Noach and his family are alone in the world. Right? On the one hand, there's 2 major sins and punishments. Right? 2 major sins. Each one has 2 major sins. Bereishis on an individual level. Noach more on a communal level are mentioned, the major sins. Each parsha has 10 generations listed. And more important, entire realities change after these major events. When man sinned with the eating of the forbidden fruit, then the reality of humankind changed. Man is now mortal. Man is kicked out of Garden of Eden. Unbelievable change. What happens in this week's parsha? The flood, the whole reality of the world, from 21 degrees temperate climate throughout the entire world. No seasons, no nothing. Now all of a sudden we get climates. Man has to depend on God. God can do what he wants with man. Tremendous changes happen to humanity. Critical cosmic events in the history of mankind. As we end the book of Noah, mankind is as bad as it can get. It couldn't get any worse. This now makes us appreciate, as we will finish up these little stories at the end of Noach, which will bring us into Lech Lecha, and next week we'll begin to see how now it's going to take us 10 parshios to destroy a world so much, only 2 parshios, to go low, and only, you know, you can gain a lot of weight in a couple weekends. Lose it takes you months. Saying the world has descended so low in only 2 parshios, it's going to take 10 parshios of the book of Bereishis to try to correct all that, and we'll get into more details, God willing, next week. Okay. All right. Hope you enjoyed yourselves, and we'll continue with Parshas Lech Lecha next week.